As soon as a fighter starts caring about literally anything, they just immediately become a paladin.
You know, I've been really self-centered for my entire life, but now I guess there's some kind of greater... Whoa, I can smite.
What? What's that light? Wait, wait.
That guy over there is a demon.
What happened? You did something without getting paid, man. Oh, that's crazy. Are all fighters that conceited? Yeah, yeah. Everyone.
Yes, yes.
You've given up 4 attacks for this. It means something.
Welcome to Monsters in Multiclass, your Dungeons & Dragons fix. I'm Kevin Odie.
I'm Jared Bornable.
And I'm Will Meldon.
And we'll be hanging out with you for a while to talk about anything and everything D&D related. On this episode, we're taking a look at the Fighter Paladin Multiclass, Modrons from the Monster Manual, and then another segment of Ask Monsters Multiclass. So pull up a chair and stick around for a while.
So actually, this is the segment from last episode's Ask Monsters in Multiclass. Somebody actually called us out, because I think in editing you left that in the intro, that there'd be an Ask Monsters in Multiclass segment, and then we just didn't have it at the end.
No, I edited that out. Oh, well,
maybe we said it on like the episode before, like the next time on, because somebody was like, what happened to like the lost segment of Ask Monsters in Multiclass? So... Yeah.
Right. I think we did mention it on 2 episodes ago next time that we thought no one listened to. Well,
we're proved wrong again.
Yep.
All right. So multiclass this time around is the Paladin Fighter. So paladins are half caster, half martial classes, given their power by an oath of some sorts or religious reasons. That kind of depends on how you want to take it. But usually they hold so much conviction that they can turn that power into pure energy in the form of smites. They have a requirement of strength 13 and charisma 13 to multiclass into. And then fighter is the trained combatant. Fighters are one of the only classes that truly highlight the amount of work it takes to accurately swing a sword 8 times in 6 seconds. But multiclass requirements are strength or dex of 13, though I doubt we're going to see that dex one come up in this multiclass. First thoughts, Will, what are you thinking?
This makes lots of sense. It seems really good, but the Battlemaster in particular is probably the worst one ever.
That's just because you hate Battlemaster?
Yeah, I hate this multiclass in particular. I don't like paladins. And I think putting a fighter on there, I don't know, it's already bugging me. It's only challenged by the fighter rogue, in my opinion.
Looking I feel mildly camp. Attacked, only because I did actually play a paladin fighter, so...
No, I mean, everybody makes this horrible, horrible choice sometime during their playing career. It's very easy to do, because they do have a lot in common, but, you know, hey, you know me.
Hates multiclassing. All right, Kevin, what are some more grounded, realistic thoughts here?
This one is obviously good. It's almost bad to do a bad combination other than doubling up on, like, taking them both to 5, you're kind of wasting an extra attack or something. But even then, it's like both fighter and paladin get good stuff higher, where maybe it's worth that kind of dead level. Arcane Archer would probably be wasted other than that. Or Regis Knight. I guess those are 2 we could talk about, but yeah, it's good. It's just like Paladin Warlock. It's good. You know it's good. You don't need us to tell you it's good, but we will talk specifics. I do find it kind of boring. There's not like all of the role-playing of a fighter of, oh, I trained for years and became a master in heavy armor and all weapons and honed my body and all that sort of stuff also would already apply to being a paladin.
Yep.
Because they also get all weapons and heavy armor and all that good stuff. So I feel like it doesn't add anything. It's really just purely mechanic.
Yeah, and I'll echo that just from the character that I did play. I was like 8 levels into Paladin when I think 7, when I decided like, oh, I should start going into Battlemaster. And it fit the backstory that I had, but it definitely didn't add anything to the character I was playing. And that... To some extent, I guess I regret a little bit. You definitely get a lot more from going into Paladin, like at any capacity. If you're already fighter and you decide to take an oath, then yeah, sure, there's definitely some great flavor there. But I would almost say that a paladin going into fighter is, for the most part, feels min-maxy, but anymore, it feels like it's taking away from your devotion to that oath. Not that it has to be an oath of devotion, but I also do think there's something you can get out of that, potentially. I like the idea of this isn't the first time I've said this. I like characters with inner turmoil, and I think that with a paladin, you have this class that's so dedicated to something. Either if it's like Oath of Devotion, where it's protecting people, if it's Oath of Vengeance, that it's just that, vengeance, where if you take a break from leveling up in paladin, to me, that seems to be almost a rejection or pulling away from that oath a little bit. And I think that's one way that you could make this kind of interesting, is a paladin who is struggling to justify their oath for some reason. And that's something that I kind of wish that I took a look at when I did do this multi-class in the first place, instead of saying, oh, it's already justified, so what do I care?
Right.
But trying to pull into that, like, well, you know, why is it that instead of going down this path of Oath of Devotion, they take a break from that for three levels? And I think there is something there, but it takes, I guess, a little more thought than just hand-waving it.
The thing is, Battlemaster does. That's what it is. You're right. Trying to butter it, but it's just dice, man.
What you're talking about could definitely work, but it doesn't feel like that's inherently obvious.
No.
You kind of have to sort of force it, to be honest. Where, like, if you multiclass into Warlock, it's... you are making a pact with a patron. That is a role-playing choice that will strongly impact your character going forward. With this one, it really doesn't need that justification. So it's sort of like, if you want it, sure, there right. It is. You're faltering on your oath. Next few times I level up, they're just going to be playing fighter levels. The other way around could be interesting, I guess, where if you're a fighter and then multiclass into paladin and then only go paladin because you're the more quote-unquote mundane fighter, and then something happens where you take an oath and start taking paladin levels. And I'm pretty sure in older editions that's what paladin was. I think it was more of a high-level prestige class. It's just they were universally better than a fighter. They were a fighter with divine powers. And in some senses, I feel like that's still held on to 5th edition. I don't know if I want to say something as bold as paladins are universally better, but in a lot of ways, they have a lot of the benefits a fighter has, and then some, with magic and smites and healing and stuff like that, while still being good with every weapon and heavy armor and still being able to hit hard.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, seriously, the only major benefit that fighters get is their extra attacks. They get to swing more, but I don't know the math directly, but I'm pretty sure that smites are going to outpace that damage every time.
I'm not so confident in that, because smites really? Pretty limited. Yeah, if you keep in mind, paladins are limited in spell slots. At 20th level, you got 6, 9, 11. So 11 times you could smite. And at 20th level, as a fighter, every single round, they're attacking at least 4 times.
That's fair.
You took a feat, which a fighter probably will because of all of the ability score improvements, another benefit they have. They're probably going to find a way to get a bonus action attack through like Polearm Master or Great Weapon Master or something. So 5 attacks. Axe and Surge, which they can do twice at level 20, or maybe even 3 times. I think just twice. 8 to 10 attacks around. Each one of those was
eight
at least probably...
8 to 9. You don't get an extra bonus.
Oh, action. Yeah, sure. Yeah, 8 to 9, yeah. Attacks in a round. Each one of those with your probably at least +5 strength to it. I would be surprised, actually, if smites over like a full adventuring day outpaced them.
No, you're right. That makes sense. I think pure fighter will probably win out damage-wise, just in consistency. If we're talking about just like a Nova fight, then, you know, over the course of 3 rounds, yes, a paladin can probably output more damage.
Yes.
But realistically speaking, you should be having, you know, 5, 6 encounters, whatever, many more than 3 rounds per day.
And if you're dumb enough to toss a paladin at your army of demons or undead, you know, then it gets a little more competitive, you know.
Right.
But it really is the goodies that makes it better.
Yeah, I mean, like, the auras that the paladins get are right away just super useful. Being able to add your charisma modifier to everybody saving throws who are within 10 feet of you. I mean, how can you ever argue with that? That's just amazing. And adding it to your own as well. I mean, that's just great. Fighters don't get that. They get indomitable, which lets them reroll a single save. That's nowhere near
as good. Well, it goes up. I don't know. I feel like...
That's nowhere near as good as the paladin auras.
So that's going to be a hard sell.
Most likely, a paladin's charisma is probably, especially if you're multiclassing like this, is going to be +2 or +3. And so at level 6, you could add +2 to saving throws around you, or you get indomitable, which, again, you get up to 3 times by higher levels. You could fully reroll a save. I wouldn't say one's better or worse. Unless, if you had 20 charisma and giving +5 to these auras, sure. That is going to pretty much always be better, because that's the equivalent to being able to reroll and essentially have advantage.
With this multiclass, there is zero reason for you to level up your stats in any way that wouldn't be adjacent to a paladin. So I don't know why you would ever have 14 charisma unless you were actively ignoring it. You could
feats
very
and stuff.
Unless you were actively ignoring it. So that's, I feel like, a small scenario where you can very easily get strength and charisma up and make those your main focuses. So we're talking about usually +3 at higher levels, probably +4, maybe very high up if you can work it out, +5. So if you do get up to even +4, that's not just +4 to all of your saving throws, it's +4 to all the saving throws around you, which is almost at advantage. So there's no limit to it.
Right.
I don't know. I can't even compare those. That seems like it's nowhere near as good to me.
My personal take is that the best and most reasonable way to make a paladin work is to max strength and charisma. Like, be forced to. Like, 18th level, 10 constitution kind of situation.
In my experience, we played a flat paladin. I've played a paladin. At least twice now, Jared, you've played a paladin. Other people having paladins. I don't think I've ever seen charisma get above 16.
I know. I believe that they are doing it incorrectly.
I'm just saying, in practice, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't get that high unless you're dealing with like a level 20 campaign.
I think I did actually end at 18 charisma, but I'd have to double check that. I don't remember.
We were getting up there. That was 14.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so with Aura of Protection, which is what does that at 6th level, it's definitely good. And it's most likely going to be better than Indomitable. But I wouldn't say it blows it out of the water, not even close. The amount of times those +3 is going to be the difference is probably about the same amount of times being able to reroll would be the difference. And again, you get that back on a short rest. So it's not like it's a per long rest thing. Or no, it's not.
No, that one is a long rest.
That's the only fighter resource that's a long rest, right?
Without subclasses, yes.
Yeah. All right, that does change it a bit. I had a short rest in my head.
Yeah, no, if it was a short rest, I would actually very much so agree with you. I mean, even just one saving throw reroll per short rest, that seems pretty reasonable. But I don't know. And you don't get 3 until, like, what is that, 18th level or something?
Yeah, you get 2 pretty early on, but...
17th level for some...
No, Indomitable, you get second use at 13th level. I don't know if I consider
third
that
level
early
is
on,
17th.
But...
Yeah, that's true. Oh, yeah, and you don't get it one use until 9th anyways.
Right. So 9th,
yeah,
13th...
It is higher, yeah.
And 17th.
Right.
It's kind of a forget-me feature.
It weirdly is. I don't...
A what feature?
You just, like, it just gets kind of... stuffed into the class and you're like, oh, hey, I'm 9th level, and you get 1, and then it just appears right. More as you go on. It fits, honestly. I mean, indomitable, you are indomitable, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I would like to see it maybe earlier, though. I also didn't realize it was 9th. All right, you're right. Aura protection is better.
See, we just have to wheedle him until he's like, oh, all right, no, you're right, we're all just dummies.
So in terms of specifics for a fighter, I don't think a paladin, just a paladin dip, would really be that great. one level you get divine sense, so you get like detect fey, fiends, and undeads or something like that.
This is horrible.
No, that pops up all the time. It doesn't show you anything, but the paladins use it constantly.
And then you get land hands, 5 points of land hands, which is beneficial. That's nice because you could use 1 point to break something back up from being unconscious, and that's probably your best use of it. But I don't know if it's worth a full dip to. Second level is where you could get a second fighting style, and then basic spell casting and divine smite. So that's where it starts to feel like it's going to be really good. But since fighters don't get any spell slots and aren't any spellcaster levels, unless you're an Eldritch Knight, which something we'll talk about in a bit here, you get 2 spell slots.
Right.
So it's 2 divine smites per long rest for slowing down your fighter level by 2. I'm just not so convinced that's worth it.
I would be inclined to agree with you there. I could maybe see 3 levels will get you your second level spells for Paladin, so that's starting to get better there, but yeah.
Five levels.
Oh, fifth,
they're,
sorry.
They're half caster, yeah.
You're correct. Wow, yeah, okay, so that's pretty hard to justify. So I think at 4, you get 3 first levels?
At 3rd, you get 3 first levels.
3, okay. So yeah, 3 smites for a 3 level dip. You do get a second fighting style, or I guess second fighting style.
Second,
unless you're champion, in which case you're getting a 3rd, and at that point it really starts to become pointless. you don't even need that many.
Right.
So I don't think I'd do it. I don't really even like the flavor of it, because I do feel like once you start to go into Paladin, it should be kind of the focus to some extent.
Right. Let me just like dip my toes in this lifestyle. I have to devote my entire being to the pursuit of this oath. And then, we're just going to back out. I'm going to keep the powers.
Right.
It feels weird. I'm sure you could come up with a reason of why, but it does feel weird.
Right. Oath of Vengeance, man. You got your vengeance like right out of the gate. And you're like, 3 levels. It happens.
Going 3 levels, though, it does start to get better, because then you get your first sacred oath. And Oath of Vengeance right away is a good one, because you get that vow of enmity where you could give yourself advantage for a minute, which is just fantastic. And it's only bonus action activated. So once per long rest ability, but that's kind of all you would really need it for.
Yeah, I mean, we say like you pursue this path unerringly as a paladin, but like you don't actually start the specific path until 3rd level, so.
That's true.
We are kind of just like tossing flavor where there isn't any demanded, because that's the point of this podcast.
It is a little weird. Yeah, we never talked about that with Paladin. At least I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, what are the first 2 levels of Paladin?
Right?
You swear to uphold justice and righteousness.
Okay.
But that's not all Paladin paths.
Right.
I mean...
Right, I'd say Oath of the Ancients has nothing to do with justice.
The justice of the trees. Yeah. Like, it's... You use these... The entire class is littered with all these, like, positive adjectives and words that are just totally subjective.
Right.
Justice and righteousness for demons to invade the mortal realm, killing every living being. As that is just. It is our land, and you are just living on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really all it is. It's like, if your fighter just starts off feeling really like they're upholding the virtues of justice and whatever else, then I don't know, I guess here's smite. But it feels so wrong.
As soon as a fighter starts caring about literally anything, they just immediately become a paladin.
You know, I've been really self-centered for my entire life, but now I guess there's some kind of greater... Whoa, I can smite.
What? What's that light? Wait.
That guy over there is a demon.
What happened? You did something without getting paid, man. Oh, that's crazy. Are all fighters that conceited? Yeah. Everyone.
Yes.
You've given up 4 attacks for this. It means something.
Yeah, it's kind of like the first semester of college. My still undeclared major.
Right.
Which is like a fine thing to do, unless you're like, you're a paladin. It's like, you just like, you know, you want to devote yourself to something higher, but you're just feeling out your options. And in the meantime, here's a little taste of the power. It's just, and it feels weird. I even though it's not written in the class, I really think you need to play it, where from the first level of Paladin, you know which oath you're going, and you kind of play that up. And maybe it takes you some time to really kind of get in the psychological headspace of fully devoting yourself, and that's why it takes 3 levels for those powers to fully manifest. That's probably how I would play it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's the best way to play it, and how anytime we've ever had it at the table, it shakes out. The only thing that I would offer is that if you are doing a more religion-based paladin, then I could see you starting off as a holy warrior and taking that oath is more of like you're taking, how do I explain this? It's like the difference between dating and in a relationship, where it's like before you're just kind of like, oh, okay, you know, I think I like this, and okay, I've got smites, that's cool. But then you get to third level and it's like, all right, let's make this official. Let's actually seal the deal here.
Yeah, like third level, third date.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Third date, you know what that means. Advantage for 1 minute until you drop to 0 hit points.
And immunity to diseases.
Yeah, right. And immunity to diseases.
Man, I always forget that Paladin just has like all these weird duds littered throughout.
Yeah, immunity to disease, I don't know if it ever came up. Or maybe it's come up once, but when it does, it's like it's really great and satisfying.
Everyone has a terrible disease. I'm a paladin. It gets past the paladin thing. This is a quest disease. This isn't one of those diseases. Actually, the monk is like everything in the monk class is these little flavor bits, but they both have similar, like you forget, oh yeah, I'm totally immune to getting thirsty or blinking. It's like, oh, thanks, book.
No, that's the wrong one. That's the is that the warlock sorcerer. Or shadow sorcerer? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, blink once a minute. That sort of thing. Yeah. Or never blink, yeah.
But I still stand by, I think that what I was saying earlier, where the idea of a paladin who's like wrestling with their oath, that one at least speaks to me from like a flavor perspective. I feel like there is more there than just... You said it's kind of forcing it a little bit earlier on, and I think that's totally true. And to me, I will challenge people to at least try and think about those things rather than just going with the easy way out, mostly because I think it would be more fun. And also, it just seems to me very difficult to hold such strong convictions for a very, very long time. I could easily see just like starting to question that. And taking a look at, like, you know, specific examples with, like, the Oath of Devotion, I feel like it's really easy to always be the one to step in front of danger when your challenge in front of you is goblins. But as that grows to demons and full-scale war, the idea of no longer, or I guess recognizing that protecting yourself might help you save others down the line, when in reality an Oath of Devotion should almost be willing to die for their oath if it means protecting people. And that's taking it to an extreme, of course, but paladins are such an extreme class as it is. But I feel like players as a whole are going to put a focus on protecting themselves as a PC, and maybe letting that one NPC die, or that orphanage or whatever, if it means that, you know, they can go on and however they want to justify it. I could very easily see that being a story moment and using.
How do you justify that one? Just like letting an entire orphanage die. Like one NPC. That was the scale you gave. One NPC
and then an
entire orphanage.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to set up those circumstances.
One round accident. The other one's like, it's multiple days of failure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to sit here and try and, walk backwards on that.
Justify why we let that happen to those orphans.
Yes. But
personal
whatever the story
came in.
Thing is. Yeah, I mean, and maybe that's it. Maybe that it does be an orphanage. Seriously, that's a dumb one. That if you step in front of the fireball for the orphanage, come on. But if it's something smaller,
it wouldn't help.
Step in front of the
fireball.
That's not
how fireball works.
It's like a turn of phrase. You know, you guys don't always say that. It's like falling on the sword, stepping in front of the fireball.
The fireball, right, yeah.
I'll save but you, then, kids. Like, roll your deck saves with a plus +3.
Still take half damage.
But, you know, it does allow them to have, like, setting up their own type of redemption arc, where maybe they start to dabble in the hedonistic lifestyle for a little bit while they explore, like, oh, hey, I can just, like, train. I don't have to do all of this crazy devotion stuff where every morning I wake up and go through my explicit rituals. Like, I can just learn to fight and just be good at fighting and also, you know, drink and smoke and everything else and just be a horrible person for a little bit, which just builds to them coming back to the paladin
Jared Bornegal. Anybody who drinks or smokes is a terrible person.
Yeah, you know,
he's saying they're a fighter, and I'm saying fighters are terrible person.
Yeah, I guess I was trying to bring it back to what Will was saying, where fighters are just self-absorbed. So maybe that's more the important thing, is they get into a self-absorbed lifestyle for a little bit, which is just like a huge change of character for them. And you could reflect that with fighter levels.
Yeah. I know we keep jumping on you, being really nitpicky on the specific words.
It's okay.
No, you bring up good points.
That's literally all you guys do. I mean, it's fine. I'm used to it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, with the stopping the paladin growth and the fighter levels, it becomes more about the paladin oath, even though it's a very inward thing. It's like, I am dedicating myself to X, whatever that is. It's power drawn outward, and it's sort of judged based on your actions in the world, really. It's very much kind of an actionable type thing. Where with the fighter, going along with what you're saying, it could be that rejection of that. All right, I'm going to stop putting all that emphasis on doing these actions, and I'm just going to be kind of, selfish, as you said, where I'm just going to just focus on just training myself because I want to, and that's that.
Right. And
So, I'm agreeing with you.
It offers a period of introspection that I think paladins are set up to avoid normally.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you could come out the other end like 3 levels later, just coincidentally after you get out of Master.
And of course.
Yeah, I'm joking.
Every time.
I'm not going to
Oh, yes, this period of introspection where I got Battlemaster dice to use in conjunction with smites. I learned much.
Look here, Will.
You mere maybe philosophical peasants can only roll smite damage, whereas I can also do trip attacks.
Maybe you go to 4, okay? Maybe you go to 4.
You don't.
Well, of course, for your extra ASI, right? I mean, you don't want to leave that on the table.
Or maybe, I mean, honestly, realistically speaking, maybe you do just go to 2. From a mechanical standpoint, a 2-level dip into fighter is still pretty good. Just getting action surge and a fighting style alone is pretty worthwhile.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, of course, you're not going to go up to 5. You're not going to make it this, like, thing where you're ruining your character mechanically, Will. Come on. We still have to optimize a little bit. But the point is I want to take that optimization that's going to happen anyways, and let's put some flavor to it that makes it an interesting story.
Right. Yeah, optimization does not have to be the enemy of roleplay. They can actually inform it in a lot of ways and shape it.
Right, but mechanics come first. I mean, let's just get on the same page.
This is like 100% unadulterated apologetics for min-maxing.
Whatever.
Which should be the subtitle for our entire podcast. How to min-max and then make other people feel like an asshole for questioning you for it.
Monsters in Multiclass: unapologetic justification for min-max.
I would step in front of that fireball.
Yep. All right, so we keep bringing up Battlemaster and like, oh, obviously that's the good one, but we haven't really talked about it. So let's
right, and before we even go further than that, I just want to say Battlemaster, I think, would be the most boring one. As somebody who did Battlemaster, it was fun. I love the mechanics behind it, but I really, really hate the flavor. I just don't feel like there's that much. Fighters are already supposed to be these like tactical masters, and this is just saying, yeah, we're still that. It's boring in the same way that Champion is. It's just a fighter, but better. Flavor-wise. Mechanically, really interesting to me.
See, to me, I don't see fighters as the tactical masters. I see them as, we're really good at all weapons and avoiding being hit, and we're just good in a fight. And that's what we are. And that's what champion is. That's champion is just more fighter. Then the battle master is the one where it's, yeah, in addition to that, I'm also a tactical mastermind. Because like arcane archer and eldritch knights and samurai don't really so much fit that tactical master.
That's fair. That's fair. Still, not my favorite flavor-wise.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. It's most of the fighter ones aren't super flavorful. It's more about, here's just kind of a blank slate.
Right.
Make the character you want. It's sort of more on making the character interesting than pulling it from their class or subclass.
When it came down to it, as your Battlemaster Paladin showed, it really was just, here are more dice I can throw whenever I want to.
Yep. And ways to give me advantage.
Yeah, their maneuvers are really just baby smites in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
The reality is it is very good mechanically.
Right. So just real quick, in case someone doesn't know, Battlemaster, their main thing is around combat superiority dice and maneuvers. When you get it at level 3, you pick a bunch of, you pick 2 or 3 maneuvers?
3.
I don't remember. 3 maneuvers. These are things like trip attack. When you hit with an attack, you can apply a trip attack to it. They have to make a save. If they fail, the target's prone. And regardless of that, you add your superiority dice, which starts as a D6. And it goes up, right?
Yes. I think it's a D8.
Yeah, it's a D8.
Yeah, there's like the feat that you can take that gives you like crappy dice, and that gives you the D6.
Right, yeah, D8. So you get to add a D8 in damage to the attack, and if they fail to save, they fall prone. There's a whole bunch of them like that. Your superiority dice you get... I really should have read this before. How many do you get, guys?
400.
Four. You have 4. Yes. And you get them back on a short or long rest. You gain another superiority die at 7th, and then another one at 15th. If you have to make a saving throw, it is 8 plus your proficiency plus your strength or dex, your choice. There we go.
I like how you're looking to us to fill in the gaps when you're playing a level 20 Battlemaster right now.
Yeah, I know. DBN just kind of like made me lazy with all this. Yeah. Just like, oh, here's like a checklist or whatever. I don't even know how I got that.
Just squares you sure click on right. And you use and buttons that roll dice for you.
Yep.
The one thing to note, though, is with that, it's a lot of these maneuvers mechanically are identical to smite. When you hit, you do X. So you can exploit critical hits with this. You don't waste them on things. And they often do translate to an extra D8 of damage.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much the majority of these, the first line is when you hit a creature with a weapon attack, which is the same first line as smite, I'm pretty sure, roughly. That might be melee instead of weapon, but whatever. So you could you never really fully waste them because you choose to apply it after you hit. And it does not take a bonus action or reaction or anything like that. Neither the smite. So you can absolutely hit something, apply a maneuver and a smite to it, which adds damage. And then usually the maneuvers have some sort of riding effect, like knocking them prone or shoving them or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and then there's ones where it's outside of being hit. You could command people or lunging attack or evasive footwork where you add stuff to your AC, things like that. But
yeah. And my play on it was definitely trying to do a little bit of crit fishing I used most of my superiority dice to trip. And then tried to get advantage and, you know, get crits off that. I think in play, it just about never worked. Like maybe like 3 times or so did I actually like get the trip off. Or we were just fighting things that like, yeah, you literally can't make this go prone. I'm like, oh,
yeah, okay, yeah. Well, that's not going to work. I saw that constantly. It has to be, you know, larger, smaller. I trip attack the huge thing. It's not going to fall over. That's not why I'm doing that, idiot.
Yeah, I'm just doing it for the D8. But then riposte, which is when a creature misses you with a melee attack, you can use your reaction, expend a superiority die, make the melee weapon attack, and you can add the D8 to that damage as well. You can smite off that. So that was probably used a little bit more often, just as a way to get more damage, get an extra attack in a round.
Yeah.
And then I had...
it's universally good stuff for paladins.
Where was that last one? The, like, menacing attack, where they have to fail a wisdom saving throw or they're frightened. I tried to use that, and that one, I'm positive, never worked. Not once.
It was an Out of the Abyss, the demon fighting campaign.
Yep.
Guess what generally can't be frightened?
What? Is it demons?
Demons. But no, I mean, I think I took that one because like it was one that added to the damage, and I was like, I don't have any more that I really care about, so.
Yeah.
I regretted it, though, a little bit.
Yep. Yep, easy way to add damage. Oh, you know what? Actually, they may not be. Like, I just pulled up, like, the Yoklo, which is a higher level demon. It's not immune to frightened.
I think they just had really high wisdom. I don't know about Yoklo specifically, but yeah. Whatever we were fighting, like, my save for it wasn't off the charts by any means because it's, what, 8 plus proficiency plus strength, and I was focusing on charisma for a good amount. So right. I just couldn't get it up to a save that, you know, rivaled, like, Wizard 17 or anything. It was, like, 15 right. or 16, and that's just easy to pass on wisdom saves. They're some of the most commonly high things for high-level monsters.
Right. Yeah, and you were higher level when you did this.
Right. So, looking at fighter subclasses, because I know you said, like, before we get to the other ones, let's briefly talk about Battlemaster. Here we are, 10 minutes later or whatever.
You're probably going to go Battlemaster, man. Spoiler alert. It's a pretty good choice.
I liked Samurai from our discussion last time we brought up Samurai. Was Will, you mentioned that they are kind of the equivalent of just an honor warrior if you strip away the, I guess, the Japanese influence from it. And I think that fits extremely well with Paladin without too much of a stretch. And their third level ability is that Fighting Spirit, which is absolutely great. They can give themselves advantage on all of their attacks in a turn. So if they use that Fighting Spirit, they get their temp HP, and then they can dish out, let's say, 4 attacks if they Action Surge, all at advantage, and try and crit off of that, of course. Or just doing more attacks, more damage, always a good thing.
Right.
It's also there. It's one of the weird fighter subclasses that, like, briefly offhand mentions charisma because, you know, are the elegant courtier. That's never going to come up, but it is actually a pretty good combination of things that make sense together.
Yeah. Right,
but not until 7th level. Do you get that?
Nor is it particularly good. It's just a weird combo that shows up.
Yeah. Oh, and as your wisdom. Yeah, at 7th level, when you make a persuasion check, you gain a bonus to the check equal to your wisdom.
Yeah, it's...
So it's actually not really that good for that at all. You gain proficiency in wisdom saving throws, which is always nice.
Yeah, but I'll agree, that's not particularly great. But this is one that I could see from a normal gameplay setting where you might be higher level samurai, and then something happens story reason that makes you go down Paladin. And I could justify going to 5 in Paladin when you already have 5 in Fighter a lot more than I could the other direction. Because at least with level 5 Paladin, as we discussed, you'll start to get higher spell slots. Maybe you are just entirely bored of the Fighter class and your table isn't going to let you do any type of re-levels or anything like that. You might be somewhat wasting a level up at 5th level Paladin, but it's not the end of the world, I don't think. You're still going to get something out of it, and then you can keep going Paladin for as long as you want. So I could see that happening if somebody just gets bored of their samurai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of other subclasses, so like Eldritch Knight is one we should talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
The saving grace for this one being... You would still get spell slot progression at least a little bit. It's very slow, though.
Right.
You only bump up 1 spellcaster level every 3 levels of Eldritch Knight, which is a little rough and slow, but you can use it to fuel your smites. I don't know if there's anything in this specifically that's great with Paladin, though.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was coming to as well. Like, the slots are nice and everything. The Weapon Bond, which is their 3rd level ability that just lets them basically always have a weapon on hand. I don't think that...
They summon it.
Yeah, they can summon it. Thank you. I don't really know if that adds anything to a Paladin. And I'd say no, not really. I mean, it's just there and it's good. I like Weapon Bond, but I don't love it. It's not like worth going into Eldritch Knight for. And then their 7th level ability of War Magic. It's when you use your action to cast a cantrip, you can make 1 weapon attack as a bonus action. It wouldn't be bad with a Paladin, but paladins don't even get cantrips, so you're still just stuck with your Eldritch Knight ones, which come from the wizard subclass.
Right.
And that uses your intelligence modifier for everything, which in this multiclass, why would you want to throw intelligence in there?
Right. Yeah, you're already fighting between strength and charisma.
So you might just give yourself like Booming Blade if you're there, just to have it. And then you've got Booming Blade and then a bonus action attack.
And then I think you could take Shield.
That's, oh, yes, you would get Shield, yeah, as a spell.
Yeah, you could take it if you want.
So, and Will, I see you shaking your head the second I mentioned Booming Blade. We yelled about that last episode, so we can't do it again. But
that's why I shook my head and didn't say anything, man.
Yeah.
Although, we have plenty of time. We should probably do another segment on Booming Blade.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't love it, but hey, the option's there. You still get your two attacks. And I think it's pretty fitting for that type of multi-class.
Mm-hmm. Another bad one, Arcane Archer.
Yep.
I don't see that working at all.
Archidon.
Smites and all the paladin stuff do not work off of ranged attacks. And Arcane Archer is being about ranged attacks.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure it also relies on intelligence, if I remember correctly.
I can never find it. There's like one little part where it's like, oh, and by the way, you need intelligence. And it's just like hidden in the text somewhere. So, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, like if you have a save or something.
I really can't find it.
We probably
It is. No. It's under the Arcane Shot options. It says, if an option requires a saving throw, your Arcane Shot save DC equals 8 plus proficiency plus intelligence.
Yep, there it is.
So I've talked about that before, about how there's ways that you can go Arcane Archer and not rely on intelligence very much. So at least there's that, but you'd also be switching between ranged for your arcane shots and then melee if you want to smite, and you're just getting rid of any synergy that was there.
Right. It'll give your paladin some ranged options, but I think there are much cleaner ways to do that.
Yeah.
Than arcane shot.
Like a slingshot.
Just like any regular ass fighter dip.
Yep.
I mean, you could just pick up a longbow and... Well, then your dex is bad. That's the problem. Because paladins get that too.
Yeah, that's why they...
Yeah, I mean, Eldritch Nice, then, yeah, you'll get like a cantrip of like Fireball, but then you're relying on intelligence, so... You know what? Just don't... You're not ranged.
Yeah.
Just don't worry about it.
I just...
I'm carrying a character that does literally everything, man.
Now...
Or go Asimar, as you did, and then you could fly under certain circumstances.
Right, as long as the Beholder's eyes...
Of course!
Hey man,
just, I mean, SMR paladin is like super fitting. I mean,
yeah,
and I could have said Arakarkra or the Tiefling variant that could fly from level one that everyone seems to hate.
I don't actually remember that one. I'm sure it was in the Mordenkainens where they added a whole bunch.
There's like 500 new Tieflings. You have a tail and you can bounce on it. You have wings and you can fly, which is balanced with the other ones, which are like extended dark vision. He's like, no. Here's a new rule. If you can fly and you aren't a wizard with the fly spell, fuck off. It's for birds.
That's a good rule. That's a great rule right there. Now, as for a subclass that does work, Cavalier is pretty interesting. Pairs pretty well with the paladin. If you want to be a mounted polearm paladin, I think it works even better. You get the benefit of, at fifth level as a paladin, you get your second level spells and find steed, so you don't need to buy a horse anymore or worry about it dying as much, as you can just summon one. And the unwavering mark that you get at third level of cavalier is super great, lets you tank a little bit more. And I just overall think that's some great synergy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, just role playing.
Right. Like, I don't even have anything more to add. It's one of those, like, yeah, like, yeah, you're a paladin riding a horse and you're really good at it.
Yeah. And then for the Oath of Devotion or any sort of protector type paladin, unwavering mark fits.
Yep.
About protecting other people. And
yeah. So this is if you want to make your paladin more paladin-y and like, just, you don't want to worry about the flavor at all. I wouldn't, you could continue on your paladin oath and you just took three levels in cavalier or fighter cavalier. Just, it just makes sense. I have nothing more to say.
Yeah. I mean, champion is... we don't need to go through every single one of these. We never do that. But I think champion's kind of the last one, I think.
Nope, there's one more after.
It's... Oh, Echo Knight. Shit.
You forgot Purple Dragon Knight!
Yeah, what do you mean? I was going to say Purple Dragon Knight.
Heavy Purple Rhino Knights.
Champion's fine. Just like everything else, champion's kind of dull. It does fall behind damage to like Battlemaster and its will with this combination too. What if you just kind of want that simple thing? Crit more, which is nice for Paladins. Paladins critting more is always great because it doubles your smite damage.
Super good for that.
Get an extra fighting style. Sure. You know,
that's a 10th level.
It makes a lot of sense if you want to do Battlemaster, but you know for a fact that you will not remember your maneuvers. Mathematically, Battlemaster is better, but like this is just easier to remember.
If the idea of getting 3rd level spells as a paladin frightens you, then champion's a great dip.
Champions, man. Champions are the most powerful players in D&D.
So anyways, Echo Knight... I hate the flavor of this combination. I can't think of any reason why a dip in Echo Knight makes sense. The Echo Knight is, for people not familiar, a newer subclass that came out in the Explorer's Guide to Wildemount. And it's very focused on the specifics of Wildemount and engaging in time magic, dunamancy. Why a paladin would start getting involved in dunamancy, I honestly can't give a good explanation, but mechanically speaking, it's really good.
Yeah. Well, other way around, a Echo Knight
takes
an oath and they kind of abandon Dunamancy, but they still have what they had.
I still don't know what Dunamancy is, man. I don't know whether a paladin would go into Dunamancy or not.
It's so the specific flavor is your Echo is like is pulling you from a different time period to help you now. So it's like, it's an echo of yourself. Time magic.
Okay.
I'm just repeating what I know here, so not much. Point is...
Let's see. Yeah, the Echo Knight has mastered the art of using Dunamis. Yeah, I said that right, Dunamis, to summon the fading shade of unrealized timelines to aid them in battle.
So...
Anyways, go on.
You know, maybe a paladin who's... really obsessed with the past.
What's unrealized?
Yeah, this is like
right.
The alternate. Yeah, yeah. We have to have like regrets.
Yes, yeah. That's what I meant. Like
major regrets. Yeah.
Where they like they made a mistake in the past, and now they call upon an echo of themselves to make sure that they can get an extra attack as a bonus action.
Maybe in some parallel world, there was a vibrating 14 plus my proficiency bonus AC with one hit point thing that would have given me an extra attack from a distance.
They've made a mistake in the past. They regret it. And they believe there's that alternate timeline where they did not make that mistake. And they also believe this is the echo that they're pulling from. And they feel more comforted having that better version of themselves that didn't fuck up.
Okay.
Around. Maybe it's so much so they feel if they keep working this and keep pulling it, they could actually swap places and go on the other timeline.
Okay. I actually like that.
And become the Echo.
Boom.
I do. I like that. I don't love the idea of that specifically for Paladin, but I will say as a whole, that concept just fits perfectly with really any class trying to go into the Echo Knight.
I keep seeing Dunamis and thinking tsunamis. Dunamis?
Why? What?
Because
it's spelled like tsunami, but with a D instead of a TS.
Okay.
So Dunamis.
Gotcha.
So if you want to just throw all that flavor out and just say it's your Dunami and just scream, Dunami! What is that? I don't know. It just comes out of nowhere. It's the Dunami. Can you smite through your Dunami?
Oh, that's a good question. So there,
when you take the attack action on your turn, any attack you make with the action can originate from your space or the echo space.
Hell yeah.
So yes.
Yep.
I would tell you this. Yes. It's basically like you attack, you're kind of consist in two spaces. You can make the choice for each attack.
That's dope.
Yeah. You could also do an opportunity attack through the echo, which you could also smite off of. So that's nice. And then, yeah, they also have the... Yeah, just the real quick, that mechanical is, we'll kind of set it rapid fire to make a joke, but just to reiterate it, you can, as a bonus action, bring an echo in. There's no limit on the amount of times you do this. It's just, it's a bonus action. And you can bring it back. It has AC 14 plus your proficiency, only one hit point, and immune to all conditions. So it will die a lot, but again, you can just keep bringing it back. And then when it's out there as a bonus action, you could swap places with it as long as... Oh, at the cost of 15 feet of your movement, regardless of the distance between you. This thing does disappear if it's more than 30 feet from you, though. You get attacked through the echo space instead of yours, and you could get an opportunity to attack through the echo. In addition, at third level, you can with Unleash Incarnation, you could heighten your echo's fury. When you take the attack action, you can make one additional melee attack from the echo's position. You can do this number of times equal to your constitution modifier. So that's a little bit of a tricky bit because you're kind of already dealing with strength and charisma, though most likely con will be your next highest one. That being said, you're probably going to have plus two to it, so you could get two attacks per long rest. That's not the main reason to go this.
No, definitely not. All of that said, every time I look at this class, I just get a little bit upset. I feel like it's just too good. You get too much at third level.
It's a really good third level tip. It definitely rivals Battlemaster. But I would say it's kind of on par. Battlemasters get a ton as well. It's more like everything else is behind Battlemaster and Echo Knight at third level.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well.
So yeah, that's a good one. That's all of that. All three of those things you get with the Manifest Echo is just universally good with the Paladin. Just a melee character in general
right.
will really benefit from this.
Yep, and now thanks to Kevin, you have a way to justify it.
Oh yeah, you're welcome.
You monster.
That's my specialty, taking like really strong, broken, mechanical things where it's like, why would anyone play that other than min-maxing and then applying a story over the top?
I like my complete opposite approach of, what's that? That echo, I don't know. I call him the Toonami.
This is why you thrive in goofy campaigns.
Because they're the best. Why'd you do the thing? I don't know why I'm here.
There was something in front of me, and so I started attacking it.
Chaotic stupid.
Yeah, I have nothing more to say on Echo Knight. It's good.
Yep.
At higher levels, they're not so much combat utilities, but like really good out of combat. You can like scout through your echo and stuff like that at 7th level. Just good stuff.
Yep.
In terms of Paladin subclasses, I think they're all fine. It just depends on what flavor you want. Like, I don't see any reason any one of them wouldn't work.
Yep.
Beyond some of them, just in general, regardless of multiclassing, feel a little weaker.
Yeah, definitely with you. I mean, I think we've said before, the Oath of Vengeance is going to be extremely useful just because of their channel divinity, which gives you advantage on all attacks against one creature. It fits that Paladin. It's good. I don't know. I don't have any more to say.
Yeah.
They're all pretty good.
You also get Hunter's Mark.
Yep, Hunter's Mark would be great. All of the auras at 7th level, I mean, it's just a matter of what playstyle you're looking for.
Yeah.
None of it is bad.
Nope. Oath of Glory, the new one, and the Mythic Guide to Theros, is, as we discussed, is pretty weak early on. But at higher levels gets much better.
Right.
That's one that does fit super well with a fighter, because the Oath of Glory is also a lot about like training your body. That's, you know, it's Greek and inspired.
Right.
So you kind of like have the body of a Greek god. It's like, that's quite literally what they're doing.
Very much so. See like a 3-level start into fighter and then making your way into the Oath of Glory for the rest of the level up. I think that's well fitting.
Right. But yeah, I don't think I have any other thoughts on this. It's just to summarize what we've been saying, that it's pretty much just all good. You don't even have to justify role-playing wise, but we encourage you to add some extra character options and interest and dynamics to your character. Couple bad traps, but those stand out.
Yeah. And even the traps aren't the end of the world. There's so many worse.
Yeah, Arcane Archer is.
Yeah, okay, yes. You're right, you're right. Yeah, there's some subclass issues, potentially. Yeah.
Yeah, any other thoughts on this before we move on?
Nope, not at all.
Everybody's just going to be a fucking Battlemaster, man. Whatever.
I don't know, Echo Knight really does rival it.
Which is honestly worse, because now you're even pulling from an even more obscure source.
Yeah.
One of us needs to play an Echo Knight. Maybe that's what I'll do in our mini campaign coming up. Just because we keep talking, just straight Echo Knight. No ridiculous multiclassing.
Okay.
It's are fine. You not? We'll talk about that.
It's okay. Cool. If it doesn't fit. I don't, no. I don't.
Just because we talk it up so much, but we haven't actually played right. It, and it is kind of its unique sort of system. It's like maybe in play, it's actually not as good as we think. That could be one of those where I could see that kind of actually ended up being disappointing.
Yeah. If it's what you really want to do, let me know. I'm sure we can.
I'm not really.
But
I'm not really set. It would just be more to see how it plays.
Right. Fair enough. Well, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go ahead and move on to our promotional minute. If you are not yet, make sure to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review literally anywhere. I mean, just like write it down and just throw it to the wind. That would be pretty cool. We won't find it, but maybe somebody will and they'll start listening, which is awesome. Otherwise, follow us on Twitter. It's @monsters_multi. Subscribe to our subreddit, which is @monsters_multiclass. And then if you want to support the show, you can by going to monstersmulticlass.com/support. And we have a dice affiliate, Metallic Dice Games. They have awesome, awesome dice that you can get 10% off on using the code MM10. You can buy merch, and you can subscribe to our Patreon, where we're trying to work towards transcribing all of these episodes. I won't say all of them because there's a lot to go back on, but at least new episodes, so that way you can have a text version of all of our words. And with that, let's move on to our monster of the week, unless Will has anything to say about our promotional minute. Anything, Will?
No, great job as always, bud.
All right, let's move on to Modrons. Jeez.
This is a pretty simple one.
I know. Modrons. I don't know why I got all tripped up.
For this episode's monster, we're taking a look at the Modrons from the Monster Manual. The Modrons are quirky little mechanical beings that embody and represent lawfulness. So they're all lawful neutral. They serve a prime directive from their god Primus and have a very clear hierarchy and order of command that's represented both in their physical abilities and also how they act in accordance with each other. They're kind of fit this unique role because they're not the typical thing that you would fight because they're not evil, they're not looking to conquer the world or anything like that, but there could definitely be reasons you come up and butt heads with them. So kind of a lot here to dissect. 5 different stat blocks in the Monster Manual and lots to dive into. What are you guys' thoughts?
Yeah, so I'm actually, if anything, having a hard time coming up with reasons why the party would be facing off against any Modrons. Not to say that there's no reasons whatsoever. I just don't know if it fits a typical party just because they are this pure embodiment of lawful. I think they're absolutely great if you want to stomp down murder hobos, and there could be some interesting ways to throw that in as like a punishment to players. But the idea that players are doing something that steps on the very idea of lawfulness, and as such, Primus has decided that they need to send some Modrons to stop the party. I don't think you're going to be seeing that on a daily basis.
No, definitely nothing like that. It's so a bit on their lore. They are absolute law and order. They're mechanical creations. They have no individual concept and completely lack morality or ego. They don't refer to themselves individually. It's all we or us. It's just a collective whole. All Modrons will take orders from higher ones, higher up ones in the hierarchy without any questioning or wavering or anything like that. And ultimately, the orders come down from Primus, so he basically, or it basically, controls them all. And yeah, and Primus's kind of MO is the embodiment of law. It's lawful neutral, so it's not good, not evil, just lawful neutral, just trying to make the multiplanes as lawful as possible. So society in general leans more lawful than chaotic. Like a good functioning, healthy society, village, town, whatever, is going to be more lawful than chaotic. And so because of that, I think Modrons are not seen as trouble because they're usually going to line up more. I think an interesting way to take it, though, is Modrons who take the lawful too far. Because even within those well-functioning, lawful societies, there's still, you know, we're bits of chaos. Right. You have people walking down the sidewalk at varying speeds, or in the wrong lane, or cross the road where they're not supposed to, or someone takes off for lunch 20 minutes early. Ooh. And for us, it's just kind of like an accepted, all that is an accepted thing. To Modrons, maybe that could be seen as a complete affront to nature and needs to be met with extreme punitive measures. Maybe you have a city where they're dealing with a lot of issues and people acting chaotically, in a sense. A lot of criminals popping up and stuff like that. And so the rulers make a deal with Primus to send in a large chunk of your Modron army to help restore law and order to the city. And it's taken too far. The Modron's idea of how this lawful city needs to act is not reasonably obtainable by the citizens of that city. And so you start coming up with you start kind of hitting up against these really big issues, and the adventuring party gets hired by the original leader. Like, all right, you need to help me get out of this contract. You need to clear the Modrons out.
And I guess one thing that I would be, I guess, struggle with as a DM putting that together is creating a reasonable path forward for this to be stopped, because as I understand, they can just be made endlessly. If one is destroyed, then they have this weird like hierarchy system where if like a pentadrone gets destroyed, then the quadrone becomes a pentadrone and the tridrone becomes a quadrone, and they like, you know, go up the right. hierarchy, and it all goes to the very bottom where Primus just makes a new drone. So it seems like it's endless. Like, I don't see a like, oh, okay, we defeated them all and they won't come back, because
that gets more into the, what I think is more interesting than the Modrons, because they're kind of a dull monster, but the general concept is the concept of Primus and the Clockwork Realm, of this unerring lawfulness set to kind of ensure this steady clock rate of the universe. And you know, the contracts that he would might be give out. That's the interesting thing. Beating up all the Modrons is, you know, they're no more interesting or less interesting than an army of goblins.
Right.
Getting out of the contract, I mean, these guys are just fodder before that.
Right.
But they are fun. And the important thing to remember is that they have zero will of their own. They literally do what they are to do. As the DM, you define that. And the best way to set your players in conflict is make them do a thing that maybe your players don't want them to do. Even on accident, you're allowed to. I mean, there's no real negative stipulations when you start fighting these things. I don't think Primus actually personally cares.
That's true. That's true. I would be shocked if he paid any mind to 1,000 of these things being wiped out. It's just part of the universe. Carry on, make some more.
Right. And also keep in mind, they don't have the ability to like teleport and just be like put wherever they need to be. They need to physically. So if you wipe them out of a town, even though more will be made, they need to physically arrive there. And so that can also buy time, or maybe it is so far out of the way where it's just like, all right, that's a lost cause.
Right. Or, you know, like if you're, this is getting way too specific, but whatever, that's what we're here to do. If the original contract that leader of the town set up was that you will send 1,000 Modrons to come and fix this problem, then getting rid of 1,000, which would be the longest way to do it, would take care of the issue. But basically that idea of just like there is a set number, it's not going to be an unending just torrent of them, unlike the great Modron march that happens.
Right. Right. Which is definitely an interesting thing to talk about and why you could be running into these. So like clockwork, once every 17 gear rotations of Primus, which comes out to every 289 years, the Modrons flood the material plane and go on a great march. The exact motives are hidden. No one's 100% sure why, but the general thought is it's just kind of reconnaissance. See, it sort of lets Primus, that's another one. I'm just going to keep going back and forth.
That's okay. Say it.
see how the material plane is doing, and all these Modrons report back. I like the little flavor text in the Monster Manual, the little kind of quote. Every 289 years, the entire multiverse goes mad, like clockwork. So it sounds like these things just show up everywhere.
Right. Right, which I think in its own right is the, I don't want to say like a random encounter, but at least like a short adventure that comes up of just like the, I'm sorry, I'm getting deja vu. And Kevin, did you say that we already did this one? Because now I feel like yes, we did, and I'm not sure if that's because of the Modrons being like clockwork, and I'm
So I think there's two reasons it feels really familiar. They played a somewhat big part in a chapter of Out of the Abyss. You met them, and they were actually the group of Modrons that you met in Out of the Abyss were lost from the Great March.
Right.
They've been wandering the Underdark for 200 years trying to find their way out. And then we definitely talked about them when we talked about the Slotty,
okay,
who are kind of the opposite. The Slotty were also created by Primus. They're ones where it's sort of like kind of seen as by mistake, but Primus making such a major calculation error seems unlikely. And so it's sort of like a hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You probably did it on purpose because that's lawful and balanced because they're chaotic neutral. They embody chaotic neutral, where the Modrons are chaotic lawful. So they kind of needed a balance. And I know we've dove into the Modrons when we talked about the Slotty.
Okay, that must be it, because I'm like,
yeah,
that was staggering. But what I am thinking is like when this first begins, this Great March, and they flood the cities and towns and everything, that would be shocking for most people. So I could very easily see just adventurers attacking them because they're like, what the heck are you doing here? And they just completely ignore everybody. And it's like, no, you need to get out. And some like the leader of the town just like, get rid of these things. And right. then it's a matter of, you know, your party's attacking them. And maybe they find out like, oh, if we just leave them alone, then we just, nothing happens.
Right.
Could be an option.
So outside of setting up scenarios where you fight these, I think more commonly, and probably maybe the intent is these are more present to interact with in storylines and stuff, not so much encounters. And they have stat blocks where you might fight alongside them, or it's just kind of needed, but it's not the important thing. Like, you're right, so your adventure is around during that great Mordon March. That's just kind of an interesting thing to see, right, and look into. And it's like, yeah, maybe you're not fighting them, but that's fine. Like, everywhere you go for like the entirety of this campaign, there's Morgons just everywhere, and every town's kind of thrown into a bit of chaos because of this. And then, again, it's not so much, all right, we need to kill these, it's just they're causing various issues, or you're just looking into it, or it's just flavor to add. Or like in Out of the Abyss, they were in there, you guys didn't fight
them. Nope.
You found one that was locked up by a beholder, and you helped him get back to his lost group, and then you helped them get out of the labyrinth, and there was just kind of some benefits there, and they led you to the maze engine, the Orderer, which we're starting to get into bigger spoilers, so I'll stop there. But again, you didn't fight them, but if you guys were attacked with them, now here's a stat block so you know how what sort of hits they'll survive and things like that.
And I mean, we could have fought them. I think it's an interesting test for your players. Like, yeah. Here are a bunch of bizarre, weird-looking shapes. They don't appear to attack you. I attack them. A lot of parties are...
they're going to do
anything
that.
That's not explicitly on their side, fuck it.
Yeah, it's true.
Some people go outside during cicada season and smash all the cicadas.
Yeah, that's...
a weird thing to do, man, but...
just messed up. I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I do like the idea of using this to just make murder hobos' lives harder. Yeah, just like a way to kind of say like, hey, your party's been too chaotic. You've done too many chaotic things. And I just have this vision of a single like monodrone just waddling up to the party and just gives like a single message of like, you know, by decree of Primus, you four have been labeled as a threat to law in the universe. Refrain from doing anything chaotic or face the wrath of, you know, all of the Modrons, or the Modrons and the Modron army. And then it just like waddles away and the party's just like, huh, that's weird. Like, should we ignore that or should we actually heed that warning? And if and when they ignore it, then you could just have these things just pop up in other fights. Like, I just like the idea of whatever fight is going on, you just have like four of these things come out of the woodwork to make the fight harder. And the party's just like, oh, maybe this was a bad idea. And if you want it to, that can be like a whole hook that they like go down the line and maybe try and redeem themselves. Sure. Or it just stops after a while. I mean, also fine, however you want to play it. But just the idea of throwing that in to make combat harder as a punishment sounds just funny. That's all.
Right, yeah. I do kind of like them. They're just constantly showing up to harass
the party. And so they're just like, oh, this...
Just in greater and greater
numbers. Yeah, yeah. So like it starts off like, oh, this will be easy. But then like five of the pentadrones show up and it's like, oh, this is going to be hard. This is going to be a very hard fight out of nowhere. The issue is, getting to the stat blocks, I don't think these are very fun. They're not that good.
That's why I was saying is I think it's more intended. These are things to interact with. Here's stat blocks if it's needed.
Right. So that's like a single fight against them is never going to be fun. I stand by what I'm saying is if you're throwing them in with other stuff, then that can make for an interesting... Not even interesting minion, just it's just cannon fodder, something to make the fight a little bit harder. But looking at the very first one, it's the monodrones. This is the weakest of them all. AC of 15, HP of 5, has a fly speed of 30 and a normal walking speed of 30. Really basic stats, 10 strength, 13 dex, 12 con, 4 intelligence, 10 wisdom, 5 charisma. True sight out to 120 feet.
That's it. That's the one thing I think really interesting. True sight at such a low level, it's challenge rating 1/8, is kind of crazy. Like, that's a high level thing, true sight. So, sorry, I know I'm interrupting in the middle here, but Mordrons can go rogue. They could get defective. Like, it could happen through combat or something where they sort of lose their connection to Primus and sort of start acting on their own. So I could see certain groups maybe trying to cultivate these rogue Mordrons, and it might be a monodrone or a duodrone or whatever, just for the sake of keeping around, for the sake of true sight, because it means they can't really be tricked, so they can't really be snuck up on that well.
That's interesting. Yeah, that could work. So yeah, adding them in as, say, the rogue ones, as I understand, are usually hunted down, which could be its own setup that I think we'll get to later. But I do like the idea of just like somebody keeping these around to benefit them. And that's just kind of a neat interaction then.
Right.
So the next thing that they have is another word that I can't pronounce. Axiomatic. There we go. Axiomatic mind, where it can't be compelled to act in a manner contrary to its nature or its instructions. So obviously this can be gotten around because you do have rogue Mordrons, but I think the implication here is that it's very difficult for that to happen, and there has to be some supernatural ways to compel them to do something else.
Yeah, so all Mordrons have this, except for the rogue one. That's the difference in the rogue variant, rogue stat block. They don't have axiomatic mind. I wonder, though, does this mean they're immune to stuff like being frightened?
Well, the question is being frightened contrary to their nature or instructions?
I would say yes. I mean, they don't really have a self-sense or self-preservation, so what's there to be frightened of?
It's so broad, but I feel like if they wanted it to play out in that way, they really should have just added some condition immunities, because that's a thing. Condition immunities are not a new concept.
Right.
So
right.
You say it's immune to frightened, it's immune to being charmed. I mean, why isn't that say that already? It's almost like they put this really abstract thing of it can't be compelled to act in a manner contrary to its nature or instructions, and they're leaving it up to the DM to kind of decide what that means, which works well outside of combat, less so in it.
You can't make them do stuff outside or inside of combat. Like, you can't, like, enslave Mordrons. It just doesn't work.
Right.
Right.
As far as condition immunities, I wouldn't give them any. If they're frightened, they run away and then come right back. Suggestion is something that I think doesn't work.
I would agree with that.
Right. Yeah, maybe that's why it's left vague, because like just saying immune to all charm is really, really broad.
It's actually not
because
that
there's
broad
a lot of
one.
Spells where it's, you know, they come under the effect of charm. Well, charmed in this way, they do.
Usually,
like Zone of Truth is technically a charm, but well charmed in this way, they can't lie. And it's like, should a mono drone be immune to the Zone of Truth? I mean, can they even lie? I don't know.
I would say yes. Well, they can't really lie. I mean, that's its own question, I think. But I would honestly be totally fine with this getting a charmed immunity. I don't think that it would really ruin that much. And any of the spells that it would ruin, all, if you looked at them, you'd go, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Like, yeah, it's charmed and it, you know, will attack its friends. Like, well, that's not, that's against the entire point of this thing.
That's like the basic one is the charm target can't attack you.
Right.
That's totally, totally okay. I mean, that's not outside the realm of possibility from the axiomatic mind. It might just go walk and go hit somebody else.
Yeah. But if its specific directions were to attack a person, like a single person, let's say, and that person charmed the drone, would it be able to act outside of that? Because to me, I say, well, that's its specific direction. Its instruction is to attack them. I think that's
a weird thing for it to actually instruct them to do. But
maybe. But I'm not talking about more from a PC side as much as that would be, you know, a type or a certain enemy that is being sent an army of Modrones.
Yeah, I outside of go beat up one dude, I think it makes sense to not have condition immunities.
Fair enough. So next thing is its disintegration. So when these things die, its body disintegrate into dust, leaving behind weapons and anything else it's carrying. I guess that's just cool flavor. Not much else there.
Yeah, I guess it stops you from capturing dead ones. And since they're mechanical, you know players are going to try, oh, can we like mess with it and bring it back and make it our own and make it stronger and blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, it just disintegrates.
It's mechanical, so any morals go out the window. Let's open it up and toy with it.
Right?
yeah, that's fair. Then for actions, it has a dagger. So +3 to hit. Reach of 5 feet, does 1d4 plus 1 damage, or it has a javelin, +2 to hit, and does a d6 damage. Basic.
Right, with 30.
Yeah. 24 range, so, yeah. I mean, just basic stuff.
Kind of really boring.
Yeah. Now,
it's cute, though.
That's true.
Looks like a mechanical Mike Wazowski.
With wings. Yes. Who gave Mike Wazowski a fly speed?
The golden mechanical sphere with a big central eye, spindly legs and arms, wings. It looks kind of sad.
I don't think it looks anything.
He's making the lion face. I see how you can see a frown, but no, he's making the lion face, dude.
Okay.
Now, one thing that I was thinking about is the whole hierarchy thing, where if one of them gets destroyed, then like the replacement of the lowest rank ranks up rather quickly. Is that something that happens in combat? Because it's not reflected in the stat block.
I would
hope.
I mean, yeah, it's just in flavor. I feel like that's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, like if they're fighting,
it's saying always like the nearest one.
Right. And it makes it sound like it's immediate and in a flash. So it's not like, you know, a whole thing that they have to go through. So I feel like that would be really smart to set up where you have, you know, a diverse grouping of these things. So you've got the pentadrone, which is the 5, and then like a couple on the way down. The pentadrone dies because the party focuses it first, and then all of these things just rank up, and you just like kind of watch that, and it's like, oh, okay. And that's like a neat mechanic to see.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point, because it kind of, yeah, will rank up all of them because it's
right, but you don't have that reflected in the stat block, and that kind of disappoints me. Or more than anything, I guess I'll just say, as a DM, you have to be careful and keep these things in mind. If you skipped over the flavor text of these monsters, you'd be like, why would I ever use these? But here's now like a way to make it a memorable fight, at least.
Right.
I think the idea is that within... Yeah, you could do the idea that this is the entire Mordron squad, so this is the embodiment of the unit that is got the hierarchy to it. So every high rank death is replaced with a low rank death if available.
Right.
And if you want to be like really harsh on that and like teach them the lesson, hey, you have to go bottom up, you heal them. You know, this is a magical transformation. There's no reason that their hit points would retain. So, you know,
oh, yeah,
you kill the top level one, and now if somebody's been beating on the Quadrone, suddenly he's now full health Benadrone.
Oh, okay.
You can really punish right. people for not noticing the pattern if you want to. I don't know. I think it'd be an exhausting combat.
Yeah.
These monodrones that you'll need to like kind of flesh out the bottom. 5 hit points, 15 AC. It's not hard to nuke these things. You need like dozens of them. That's a bitch to run. It really is just terrible.
Yeah, and again, it's not like it's a long and interesting combat. It's like, okay, he swings again, and oh, plus 3 doesn't hit your 17 AC. Guess let's try again. The only way that I could see it is hoard them and make them a swarm of some sort so that you just have your 10 and they make 2 attacks and you rework the stat block entirely to make them feel like a swarm.
Yeah, I would definitely get on board with that because it really fits their general theme,
right,
which is acting as a unit.
Yep, definitely. So moving on to the next one, I'm not going to go into the very nitty gritty on all of these because it is basically the exact same, but the one step up is the Duodrone. So armor class of 15 again.
You guys at home picking up on that super subtle, clever little pattern.
Oh, mono and now duo.
And then duo. Mm.
We haven't mentioned the next one. So oh, we'll do a segment where you get to guess. Pause right now and see if you're right.
All right, I'm going to see you pause. It's the Trito.
What? You won't believe next just week what the fourth one is.
Yeah, we should have done an episode for all of these guys.
All right. So the Duodrone is, it gets more HP, so it's 11 instead of 5. Stats are boosted just a little bit, but again, I'm not going to read them off. That's just not worth it. It does get multi-attack, but it loses its dagger in place of fists, which you could obviously change around if you wanted to. If you want to give it a dagger, great. Oh, this would be way too much tracking as a DM, but if a monodrone upgraded to a duodrone, it should still have a dagger. I don't know why that would just, like, disappear.
But your player's just giving you shit. It's like, I know that monodrone had a dagger. Right. Make sure one of those attacks is a dagger attack, please.
Right. So if you want to track that, great. I would not. But if you want to give him weapons, I don't see why you couldn't. Otherwise, they make 2 fist attacks or 2 javelin attacks that are basically the same as the monodrone.
Right. This one doesn't have a fly speed.
Right. It does. Yep.
So basically, it's double health, 2 attacks instead of 1. It's 2 squares stacked on top of each other for duo. And it has kind of a nerdy looking face.
Yeah, it's got a Kevin looking face.
Yeah, it does.
I wasn't going to say it. I was looking at this. This dude looks just like Kevin.
Thanks, guys. I wouldn't say just like Kevin. Kevin has a lot more charisma.
Yeah. And I don't have a flat nose like that.
All right. So next up is the aforementioned Tridrone. So once again, HP goes up, same AC, no fly speed, a little bit better stats all around. Yeah, 16 HP instead of 11. Now, it gets 3 attacks. Its multi-attack goes from 2 to 3. I'm noticing a pattern now that I did not see before. Whoops. But it does have +3 on its fist attack now and is 1d4 +1. And then a javelin that has +1 instead of nothing.
Yeah.
I guess that this one does hit a little bit harder because it does get the 3 javelin attacks. Oh, no. 2 got that as well. Yeah, I got nothing. Got
2 javelin attacks.
Yep, just 3 javelin attacks.
You'll find that these actually do scale basically linearly until the next 2.
Yeah. Tridon's an upside down pyramid triangle. I can never remember.
With like big luscious lips.
Yeah.
Like uncomfortably large lips.
There's one thing where it's like, isn't a pyramid specifically 4 sides? This one does not have 4 sides. It's a 3D triangle, I guess.
Oh, there is a different name for that. Yeah, I don't remember what it is.
Yeah.
Isosceles pyramid? I don't know.
I don't know. It has 3 arms, each arm holding a javelin.
But how many legs does it have?
Oh, six yeah. lakes.
Weird.
Yeah, yeah, they could. They didn't need to make it six. It could have stood on three legs.
Wouldn't have worked.
It would have been perfectly stable with three legs.
Yes.
So next up is the Quadrone, which has four faces. No, it doesn't, actually. It, kind of a missed opportunity. I wanted these things to get, like, really monstrous, but this one's just a flying cube.
Right. So it actually seems like a downgrade from the Duodrone, which is
two cubes.
Two walking right. cubes. It's like, all right.
Its armor class does go up to 16. HP goes up to 22. It gets a fly speed back. And its stats continue to go up a little bit here. But this is a ranged one, first and foremost, where it does have multi-attack and it can make four short bow attacks with a range of 80/320. It's plus four to hit, 1d6 plus two. This actually does change up combat at least a little bit, because now you have something flying and, you know, 80 feet away that the party has to deal with. I definitely would want to throw some of these in.
And four attacks for a challenge rating one is a lot. Or three attacks for a challenge rating one half. Like, that's... It's not exactly exciting. It's not, like, dynamic and interesting, but it's a lot of attacks. 4d6 plus 8 damage for a challenge rating one, if all of them hit.
Yeah, my only issue with this as a whole is that I'm going to get tired from rolling dice.
Yeah, that's you roll them all up at once.
It's still going to be a workout. All right, last one is the Pentadrone. So this is supposedly the highest one. If you wanted to, as a DM, make a... What would a six one be? I always...
Hectadrone.
Hectadrone? Yep, there we go.
Yeah. If you want, Sexadrone!
And then an octadrone, of course. Then you could keep going further, I guess. But this stops at five. HP goes up to 32, AC stays at 16, gets 40 walking speed, no fly speed. Stats continue to go up in some ways. It's a challenge rating 2. It gets 5 attacks, all of which are plus 4 to hit, and then a d6 plus 2. Nothing's really changed there. But it does get a paralysis gas that comes back on a recharge of 5 or 6. So the Pentadrone exhales a 30-foot cone of gas. Each creature in that area must succeed on a DC 11 con saving throw or be paralyzed for a minute. Creature can repeat the saving throw at the end of each of its turns, ending the effect on itself on a success. So that changes things up.
So close to being really cool.
What kills it for you?
DC 11 con save. Like, almost nobody just completely dumps con.
Yeah.
And even if you did, it's still pretty much a 50% chance of passing. And it's most likely going to be much higher. I just don't see that landing.
So the only thing that I will give is that with what Will was saying, where if one rises up in ranks, then it becomes like a fully healed version of this. At the very least, you could probably get a lot of these off and a lot of the paralysis gas, in hopes that one person gets a bad roll, or, you know, a couple people get a bad roll, whatever. And it, thinking about how this would play out realistically, it creates a focus, because if the first turn this thing shoots out a paralysis gas, the party shouldn't know that it's a DC 11 to pass. So all that they know is that they just made a constitution saving throw, and they don't know how often this thing can do that. So their first thought is going to be kill the thing that is, you know, maybe it did paralyze somebody, or kill the thing that has the potential to do something harmful when the rest of these are just doing chipping damage. So it very much becomes a focus. You kill that one, and then the Quadrone just boosts up to a five, and now it's got another paralysis gas. So it at least creates some tension, I think.
Yeah, if they managed to land even just one round of paralysis, though. Like, with the amount of attacks these things get for such a low level, it has the potential to be extremely deadly. Advantage in every attack, and if it's within 5 feet, it's a guaranteed crit. And then, like, you know, another Pentadrone comes up and whacks you with arms 5 times. Yeah. Each one with advantage, plus 4 to hit, lower level. So each attack is 2d6, hits 5 times. That's 10d6 plus 10. Like, that's going to kill anybody that's going to be fighting the challenge 2.
Yeah. I love it. Which, I guess to some extent makes me not like it as much because it almost seems like that's coming out of nowhere and is almost overly punishing to some extent here.
But yeah. But again, it's such a low DC.
Yeah.
That's why I think this doesn't fit very well for what we often traditionally describe as the just kind of like challenging, fun, normal combats. Throwing like hordes of these things at a higher level party makes more sense to me because that is just an instant death sentence if you play it correctly.
Right.
Whereas if you're level 10, that's like not fucking around.
It'll be annoying, but you'll be fine.
Right. Now, if this was against a level 10 party, which I could see doing with the right numbers and with, again, making hordes of them, I would definitely raise that DC because that's just not going to get failed.
You can't raise the DC, bud. You got to add more. You got to add more sides.
You
maybe
just...
the dodecadron has a higher, you know, DC, but not this guy.
Honestly, though, I do like that concept. I do like the idea of having, if you want it to be against a higher level one, then you could throw up a more multi-sided one, and that could get interesting.
20 attacks on a paralyzed creature.
Yeah, I know in older editions there was other ones, so I couldn't find it in 5th edition, but just reading like just lore online and stuff like that. The up to the Pentadrone is considered the base ones, the ones that are you're going to go out in the world and do stuff. And then you have higher level ones, but they're kind of considered something that's separate. And I could not find them in any 5th edition source material.
Yeah.
So I assume it's older edition stuff.
Yeah.
Which is fine. You know, who knows, maybe it'll come out.
That would be nice. I would really appreciate more on the Modrons.
Yeah. In terms of the Pentadrone specifically, I'm kind of disappointed in its art. It's basically like a floppy starfish that's propped up on 5 legs. And it's too, like, I mean, there's curves in it. It's segmented bodies and stuff like that. And it doesn't fit these things.
It looks
everything
so
else is
organic.
Really, like,
yeah.
Yeah, organic. That's a good word for it. Yeah. Everything else is very geometric and clearly mechanical. The sphere's a little iffy of the Monodrone, but still. And then you have this. It's like, I feel like there's much easier ways to make, like, a 5-segmented thing than a organic looking starfish.
They set themselves up really, really blatantly with the geometry nature of these and then just like all over the place. Because this guy's got now 5 legs.
Yeah.
A lower number of legs than the Tridone.
Yeah, the legs are all over the place. I don't even want to talk about that.
Yeah, the Modern Drone has 2. It's like, I think it'd be cute to give it 1 leg that is the
Yeah, hop on. And like a slower speed.
Because I mean, it has wings, so it's like,
oh,
whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it could just fly.
I would like that a lot, actually, where it has like a 10-foot movement speed and then fly of 30 feet, and it just relies on its wings. Perfect.
Right.
It doesn't even need a second arm, actually.
Yeah, I was thinking one arm,
yeah, it
one leg, like hopping around, like whacking you from its head.
Right. The Duo Drone's fine. It's bipedal, 2 arms, whatever. Yeah, the Tridone with the 6 legs that we talked about. It's like, it's a 3-sided pyramid. So just have it, and it has an arm off of each side. Just do a leg off of
each
side.
And the Quadrone, they just go down to like the single face instead of making it like a 4 segmented cubes with 4 legs. I mean, it's just, for something that's supposed to be this like over the top consistency lawful thing, I don't know if this would bother me in any other way, but it bothers me with this.
Right. What they should have done with the Quadrone is they should have added 4 bows.
Sure. I'd have been totally fine with that.
Or like a firearm of sort. They have like built-in guns, basically. That has the same stats as a short bow, but...
I do like to imagine if we're talking about the ones that aren't in 5th edition, but like it continues along where you get to like 20, 30 shape or sides. And it's just like, what the fuck do those even look like? Those would be like true horrors.
Right. I mean, and naturally, when you get to the 21, it's of course going to be a D20.
Oh, like, yeah. Yep.
You just have to.
Good call. The fact that I missed that.
You roll a D20, that's how many attacks it gets. Instead of, you know, and that's how many attacks hit the party.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, natural 20.
Oh my gosh, I actually, to some extent, like that just because it could roll itself and, like, it has numbers on it. It would be a total, like, meta monster to fight.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, you know, sucks in all of its arms and then just rolls forward 20 feet and then just pops out on a number and then makes that many attacks. Or just does that much damage.
Yeah.
So there you go. Here's 20 damage.
Yeah. Just explodes. Yep. 20 damage. Yeah. I like it. I think you get to like the black sheep of the Modrons, the irrational numbers and stuff. You make them like Eldritch Horror stuff. Viewing them breaks your mind as you can't quite comprehend the shapes that you're seeing. And like Primus just kind of like got high one day and accidentally made this.
Isn't that Bractal the slotty?
Modrons. Those are just frogs, man. They're not like incomprehensible shapes of Eldritch nature. Just frogs.
Yeah. They embody chaotic evil, but is there a chaotic good? So celestials embody chaotic lawful. Mordrons lawful. I'm sorry, not chaotic lawful. Lawful good. Celestials lawful good. Mordrons lawful neutral. Devils lawful evil. Demons chaotic evil. Slotty chaotic neutral. Is there a chaotic good? I think some celestials are like a unicorn's chaotic good, but that's not like its own class of thing, like devils, demons, slotty, whatever.
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Maybe fae?
Fae are all over the place.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's like a general fae that probably is close to chaotic good. The like elvish kind of themed stuff.
Right.
Yeah, worth looking into. To bring up the slots, one idea that I had was that the whole thing with the slotty, as I understood, was that Primus kind of ignores them and is like, yeah, it's not my problem, even though everybody knows that he made them on purpose or on accident, whatever it might be. So I imagine that slotty and Modrons have not like a explicit connection to each other, but slots kidnapping Modrons and then corrupting them with chaos would be somewhat interesting to me. This idea of just making, basically they could be minions for a slot fight with like the rogue ones, because their energy specifically is corrupting them, and they above any other beings know how to corrupt these things because they're Primus's embodiment of chaos.
Yeah,
it makes as much sense as any other explanation. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got nothing else on these things.
No, they're neat little guys. I'm glad that we've talked about them because they've been on our list for a while. But boy, I don't think I'll ever actually end up using these.
The flavor is way better than the mechanics.
Yeah,
exactly. They're more to be interacted with. Here's some stat blocks just in case.
Right.
Yeah, they were great in Out of the Abyss. I'll say that. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And we did not. Yeah. I don't think combat even came up.
No, because we're not.
No,
you weren't. Why were we going to kill it? It said that it could help us get to where we needed to go. It was friend.
Yes. That you named something.
It doesn't matter.
Oh, man.
We named him March. That's all he would say. March. All right. That's everything on the Modrons, which I think we've said different every single time. You guys definitely threw a couple Mordrons in there. Yeah. There's no R.
Yeah, the Mordrons.
I keep adding that R. I don't know why.
Couple
I
of moron drones, am I right? Yeah, so let's move on to our Ask Monsters in Multiclass segment.
And we're actually going to do this time because we didn't go super long.
I don't know, we kind of did. It's still probably at like almost 2 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, we're at an hour 50.
We should skip it again this week.
You know what's actually really funny? The person who, I'm just checking this now, the person who called us out was Penguin Knight. And that is actually whose question we're answering today. So he must have just known. Anyways, the question is, again, from Penguin Knight, spelled like a elite hacker with a bunch of threes, ones, and sevens. Do you guys use a lot of traps? And if so, how do you go about making and running them?
Never even heard of a trap. Jared actually has probably a big spiel on this because I know he's been doing a lot of pretty, and I think they're pretty good experiments on complex traps.
Yeah, and a lot of that was stolen from the initial write-up by the angry GM about complex traps. Like everything of his, I take the idea of it and change it around because I feel like his everything that he does is way too gamey and I don't like it. But Yeah, I'd say the first thing that I have done is taken the concept of traps and put a couple of ways to... Geez, I should have pre-written something because I've got, I guess, a lot here. All right, so yeah, I definitely have a couple of aspects of traps that I have been trying to tackle because I find that there is an issue with the expectation of traps in a basic dungeon. So my main problem is that if you always just set up traps randomly, then the party is going to consistently look for traps, which then takes out any possible fun of a trap in the first place, because the whole point is it's supposed to catch you off guard. But that doesn't feel very fun when it's just like every 10 feet, you either pass the perception check or you fail the perception check. And then from there, it's, you know, do you pass the other check? I just don't feel like you're gaining anything out of that, and it makes it feel pretty boring. So one of the first things that I did was apply a method of learning what the trap is and making dungeons have specific themed traps. So with one that I did, it was like arcane runes everywhere. And it was basically the same one. And they offered different events that would happen if they were set off. But just seeing it wasn't enough to, you know, like use your thieves' tools to just turn it off. There was more to it that the party needed to try and figure out. So the traps themselves became a consistent thing in the dungeon, but they also were a puzzle in themselves. And let's even just start with that. Like, how did you guys feel about that? If you remember them.
No, I found it interesting. I remember that there was some reason we kept failing our rolls to see them.
Yeah.
Before they even went off. And so we ended up just getting hit a lot without having that chance to try and figure them out, which kind of slowed it down a bit.
Yeah, and that was somewhat bad luck. I remember that. So the way that it was set up specifically was there were candelabras all throughout the dungeon. Most of them were copper, but occasionally they would be gold. So that was the first thing that you as a party needed to figure out. And after a couple of times, you guys did figure that out. So from that point, I said, anytime you come across a trap, you'll at least see the trap itself and know that one is coming. But then the next step was trying to find the source of it. Where
I kind of like the idea behind it. When you have a situation, a lot of people go to this full Tomb of Horrors where every single dungeon was crafted with this brilliant, malicious intellect devoted to challenging intrepid parties of diverse, skilled individuals.
Right.
That's the dumbest thing in the world. Literally one pretty unhinged demi-lich does that ever in history. Every single cave in your world should not be like that.
Yeah.
There should generally be a pattern that you figure out, and you can keep punishing people like that to, you know, hey, figure out the trap. Don't just tank it. And then once you get it, you know, then you're all right.
Right. And say, I know that for that dungeon specifically, there was just a lot of just bad rolls left and right that seemed to make it a bit more of a slog than I think was originally intended. But the concept was still there where you guys did eventually figure out more and more of the trap and learn that, okay, there's this rune that's causing it. When it's set off, there's like three different flashes of light and they will all do different things. And that's where we implemented that, what was it? The click mechanic. That's come up a couple of times since. But the idea is that when you set off a trap, you have a moment to react in a way, and the party just explains, or the person who set it off explains. So, you know, you see a flash of light click, and when that happens, the person could say, you know, I jump back, or I cast shield, or whatever that they want to try and do to make this effect less bad, or maybe get away from it in some capacity. So
that in general, I like the idea behind it, but it just feels like a quick time event a lot of times.
Right. And that's fair. That's fair. I think I'm still trying to figure out a way to... It puts a lot of responsibility on describing the trap in a way that you all can have a chance to do something that is useful. Because if I just say, click,
right,
and you're like, well, I don't even know what I'm looking at. It's like, well, just do something. And then that...
I do a backflip.
Right.
Oh, crazy. It was literally, if you don't do a backflip, you explode.
Right, right. And so more recently, I tried to do that. But again, it's hard because I'm taking what I'm seeing in my head and expecting you all to get that as well. Where it was like some things on a wall opened up and started shooting out fire or something like that. And I think the expected thing was, oh, well, I jump back. It's like, well, the way that they're angled, it doesn't matter if you jump back. And the actual solution for that was if you jumped forward. If you moved closer to the door, you would see that they weren't actually burning the door. And that was the one place where it was safe and would have given you advantage on your dexterity saving throw instead of whatever was worse.
I think the issue is getting outside of the binary. There is a right answer to the click response. You either know it or you don't, or you're just playing this weird like dancing game where they're trying to fuck with you.
Right. And the hope, as I've mentioned, is that the first time it's really supposed to catch you off guard. You're supposed to do something and have it either you get lucky and it's right or it's just completely wrong. But by like the third or fourth time, it's supposed to be like, okay, so it's been described based on whatever reasons. Either you get some rolls to figure it out or just in general you figure it out that the fire isn't touching the door. So now I know to jump forward. Or you just expect it to be fire. So you cast Absorb Elements. And that's fine too. Now you have that option. So yeah, there is some trickiness to it where it is just supposed to be a learning experience.
Yeah, and in that sense, I like it since you keep running into the same trap. If it is just a one-off trap and it has that click mechanic, it does just feel like a crapshoot. It's just like, I have no idea. And I know recently that did happen. It was fine. It was a one-time thing. But when we were in that temple to the water temple to the water god, I know there was a couple traps where it was just like, it was the only instance of this type of trap. And it's like, oh, it's just, it's a random guess. It doesn't really matter. But yeah. And the ones where they keep coming up and it's just like slightly different iterations and you kind of learn it and learn what to look for. I like that a lot.
Yeah. And that's definitely what I'm working towards, but it is a work in progress. I have not perfected this just yet. The other thing that I have seen from my playing of Pillars of Eternity is that very often they will have it so that if you try to see the trap or like try and disarm it and you fail, I think what I've always done is if you fail disarming the trap, it sets off. But there's another very clear way that you can do this, which is you try and disarm the trap and on your roll, you get a low roll. And now you're just kind of looking at the trap and you're like, you can't figure out how to disarm it. So now your options are to either set it off and accept the consequences or leave this thing be. And I think that's actually a lot more interesting than just setting it off from failure.
Right.
So that's one with like locked boxes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, once again, it's D&D. I mean, you couldn't figure out how to disarm it. Well, fuck it. I open it. You're never going to leave a chest unopened.
No, seriously. And that's very true. Giving the responsibility to the players to say, you know, you tried, you failed, but you can still open it and just take that risk. That's fine. And maybe you... introducing that click mechanic still, you discern what the trap is and you see like, oh, it's poison gas. When you open this, it is going to spray poison gas. And the player goes, okay, I want to disarm it. You try, you roll low, you fail. Now they still know, they have an idea of what this trap is. So if they want to open it, they can say, oh, I want to open it and just throw it across the room and like, you know, close the door and just let that dissipate for a while. Or we're going to cast Gust of Wind and start moving the air away from us and down the hallway. It lets them actually, again, take some actions here when that click occurs.
Or the rogue uses friggin' mage hand.
And that's another thing that I think is worth talking about is I have recently mildly struggled with setting up traps that are actually going to, I guess, with that idea of like a locked door, you unlock it, trap flips. That's very difficult when you have an arcane trickster rogue who can pick locks from 30 feet away. And
yeah, there's options.
And
yeah.
I know we've talked about this
magic
before.
Missile, man.
True. And there's ways to counter it. Magic missiles, one, just whatever, effects that go further than 30 feet. But something that I have had to tell myself recently is just let them pass it.
That's what I was going to say. Not just because I'm that archangel doing this bullshit, but like, I mean, it's a whole class feature dedicated to basically bypassing certain right. traps. Just let them do it yeah. sometimes.
So,
otherwise, it kind of feels like, oh, well, what right. was the point?
So like, I specifically have put things in that can 100% you can get around by picking the lock from 30 feet away. And as long as you remember to do that and you remember that that's your class feature, congrats, you got rewarded. And I think to some right. extent, it feels a bit weird from the DM's perspective because they're like, well, what's the point of a trap if they can just automatically succeed on it? Yeah, there's zero consequences there, right? And the consequence is if the player's not paying attention, if the person forgets that they have this ability or somebody else jumps the gun and they forget that their person has the ability, then you still have some recourse to punish them. But overall, if you're making the players feel cool and they overcome a challenge, you're doing your job as a DM.
Right. And in terms of countering that, because there are times where you do want to make it where that's not just the solution every single time, just setting up like the area, make it cramped. It's a locked door that's 5 feet around a corner, and 5 feet from that, 10 feet from that, there's the other wall. And so, like, you kind of have to be standing right there to pick it, because you have to be able to see it.
Right.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's the boxes. It's hard to get the rogue with the boxes without seeming spiteful.
The box. Oh, like a locked box.
Yeah, a locked box.
Oh, right.
So, for instance, right. inside the box, there's a special magical trap. The first set of eyes it sees, needles just inside, right in the eyes. It's like, mage hand? Nothing. Ah, both eyes. Immediately.
Oh, when you walk up to it?
Immediately needles.
Officially, with Glyph of Warding, you can set some pretty specific conditions. So, you could do something like that, where there's a Glyph of Warding where maybe it's not the first eyes that it sees, but like when a person comes within 10 feet of it and doesn't speak the password, then it explodes. Okay, fine. But at some
point... Glyph of Warding, when the rogue thinks he's gotten past the trap and walks up to the box. Boom.
Yeah, it's just a matter of how mean you want to be, because that's the thing to keep in mind as the DM is you need to make traps that are fun. And traps can get super annoying very quickly. When it feels like there's no way around them, when it feels like it's just a way to shave off HP and hurt you,
right.
and there's nothing to overcome, it's just something to take, they suck. They're not fun.
Right, yeah, when there's no way around them, it's like an HP tax. Just as the DM say, oh, you're all sick and your HP's lower.
Right.
There you go. Now we could skip all the bullshit traps that... you're not going to be able to get
right,
past anyways.
Right. Which is why I am working towards this concept of like the traps that you learn, because those are an HP tax. The very first time you go through them, I anticipate taking full damage and it sucking, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
So.
And that light's more fire. Loser. Gotcha.
So yeah, that's been fun though. It's, I want to keep expanding on that concept.
Or if you're mad at your players, I advise you read Tomb of Horrors.
Right.
Pretty hard to beat that. Take inspiration from that and see just how twisted you can get.
What I think is even more messed up is the original intention of Tomb of Horrors. Well, okay, the entire intention was... Was it Gary Gygax created that one? Yep, yeah, and he was just like, oh, I just want to be a dick to my players. Like, that's totally fine. It's over. Go ahead.
Yeah, the story I heard, and again, who knows if this is true, it's that you had his players were bragging about how incredibly strong their characters were. It's like, oh, you can't challenge us. We'll be fine. And the guy's super arrogant. So he wrote two
Right,
because
it's like, no, I'm the DM. I can literally make whatever I want.
Right.
Now, that said, around that point was when... people like fighters or whatever would just get followers. So a lot of it was like expected that there was a 50-50 chance that if you went down this hallway, you'd get crushed. If you go down this hallway, you get to continue on. So the idea was you would just send your minions. And that's like...
Yeah, it was a multi-party. Or was it, you were supposed to have multiple characters in this dungeon.
Right, right. So like, and not just multiple characters, like literally NPCs that, I mean, depending on when this is being played, you might care about. But I feel like the whole point was it was such a war game mentality that it's like, yeah, just send the NPC down the hallway. Oh, well, we've only got six more chances at that. So hopefully the next one's right.
Which is a great way to just kind of fuck with people, I guess.
It's just goofy. I mean, it's that's all it comes down to.
I love that dungeon.
Never played it. You guys played it one day when I was out. And nobody's wanted to play it again because it's not really something that's fun a second time.
No, we played it like 7 times because people would miss a session and it was important. And it's like, fuck it, let's just play two more horrors again.
Oh.
It came up a lot.
Ah, well.
Never finished it.
But I do know it's where Throw 'em in the Demon Hole came from.
Yes.
Which, again, wasn't around for, but you guys just would chant that all the time.
It was like a stat or a carbon in a stone thing, like an open demon mouth. And within there was a sphere of annihilation, which basically there's no save to, there's no like trick to. It's like if something touches it, it's annihilated. And so it kind of became the hole.
Throw it in the demon hole.
Oh, throw it in the demon hole.
Yeah, think, what happened was like the
I think we polymorphed something.
Yeah, the ultra gargoyle, we polymorphed into a sheep. And then, you know, as soon as you kill the sheep, the gargoyle comes back. So what we did was just chuck the sheep in the sphere of annihilation.
No, that's a clever solution.
Yeah, we made a ritualistic of throw it in the hole. We like marched over there holding the sheep out.
It was great. That's great.
Anyways.
So.
I got nothing to add on traps.
So you guys haven't DM'd too much recently, but Will, you put together that one dungeon for us years ago at this point. I don't know if there's much in the way of traps, but there was a lot of puzzles. And I feel like we could probably...
Yeah, I'm more of a puzzles guy. I don't like traps personally. I think that the best way to do traps is to just stop doing them. Stop doing them entirely. And your players are going to seem like fucking idiots for session after session as they carefully open doors, check every single thing, nothing. Make this months. And then out of nowhere, bam. And they'll go back to the behaviors they might have abandoned. Who knows? And then stop again.
All right. So, Will, your advice, as usual, is bully your players at every opportunity.
Yes, but in a very specific and psychologically damaging way.
That actually does remind me that one thing that I have completely thrown out is that idea of having players like actively search for traps at all. If you're in a dungeon, assume everyone is searching for traps and switch to passive perception. Do not make everyone roll perception checks all the time. It's such a waste.
Yeah, if your players don't like that, tell them they can switch to not actively perceiving things and just don't use it at all.
Yeah, just bam. Walk blindly and I will set off every trap.
I don't know if I agree with just using active passive perception, because you as the DM know what they are. And so as you're making this dungeon, you're basically deciding, oh, they'll catch that trap, they won't catch this one. It kind of like you're just, I don't know, I don't see this.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's what I do every single time. Literally every single one.
So you put traps in there knowing that the passive perception is going to be high enough that we'll just see it, and that's
that. Because it is.
And then other ones that are planned to miss and be hit by.
I set a DC for it, and it's based on how difficult it should be.
So that comes back to the kind of preordained thing. It's like you're pre-deciding what we will pass and what we won't. And so just tax us HP at the beginning.
At the beginning, sure. Like, but the point is that once you guys get hit by that trap, now you know that, hey, this one you figure out, again, the candelabra was a different color. Well, now the DC on the passive perception comes down.
Okay, so you adjust it based on that.
As it becomes easier for you to figure these things out, you might...
I was talking more about the typical, here's a pit trap. Here's a pressure plate that shoots fire. You know, that's sort of more typical things. If it's just, if you're using passive perception, I don't see the benefit in doing that stuff. Just have them roll for it. Otherwise, it's... again, you're just deciding how much HP you're going to dock them as they move through the dungeon. And they have literally no choice in the matter. At least let them roll for it.
Well, so,
they do. Dex save.
Yeah, I'll say sometimes the roll comes from after that. And it's also a matter of who's in front. You know, did you make the least perceptive person go in front, or did you put your person with the highest passive perception in front in the long hallway? So if the person with the lowest goes, no, they don't notice it because they're not as good at this. But maybe they're really good at dexterity saving throws, so the dart trap just completely misses them. So maybe it's right. A matter
I think the
of not...
The thing worth noting is you do have to add what you tried to do is this extra dungeon thing is there is a cost to actively being perceptive throughout the entire dungeon that some people just ignore. You know, you can't roll a perception check every 30 seconds without that seriously, seriously slowing you down.
Right.
And if there's no cost to that, they'll do it all the time. And it just doesn't make for a fun or interesting game, in my opinion.
Right. And what I'll say as a follow-up is, and I don't know if I've done this in the past, but thinking about it going forward, to me, if relying on that passive perception is what you want to do, should probably have traps that you can succeed and take zero damage from. Like, if it's a dex save and you still are going to take half regardless, then it becomes an HP tax. But at least the roll is on activating the trap. It isn't on perceiving right. It in the first place. So, yeah, I think we're... still figuring it out. Traps are a tough one. I don't think that there's been too much. I've used, you know what? There's still more to talk about. I have used the complex traps from Xanathar's Guide, which I don't know if you guys have ever read up on.
Yeah. I like that a lot too.
And I have used those before where it's like there's a lot of things that are specifically happening. And I think I used them most often in a campaign that neither of you two played in. But there's one that's like, something at the very end of a hallway is causing everybody to constantly have to make wisdom saves or they become frightened, which of course makes them run the opposite way, I think, or it was stand still. Either way, we'll say they ran the opposite way. And along the path, there was a bunch of swinging arm blades and pit traps and whatever else. So they had to make their way towards the other end of the hall while dealing with all of these hazards. But they could interact with each set individually, where maybe they could use their thieves tools to disarm the swinging arm blades, or they could, if they could jump far enough, they could get over the pit traps, or they could use a spell to allow them to levitate or whatever, all while dealing with this arcane object at the end of the hallway that was causing them to be frightened and keep running backwards. So things like that I find really tough to set up. I think that's like the actual example in Xanathar's that I just stole. But there's still, it's like a neat concept of having traps in initiative and actually like having to go through and tackle each problem one at a time, but being totally aware of them.
Yeah, I really like the complex traps. And to me, those feel more like puzzles than traps.
So. Fair.
Where there's a lot of things you have to work out. You guys kind of ran through a dungeon of those at the end of Out of the Abyss. I sort of homebrewed like the last sort of major kind of typical dungeon thing. And I put a bunch of complex traps in there, some take, some modified, stuff like that. And I thought that one ended up being really memorable. I know I enjoyed running
it. Yeah, no, I loved that one. That was a really good dungeon. I can't remember any specific traps, at least not enough to talk about them.
The one that's jumping out to me was the classic thing of got locked in a room and was filling with gas and there were statues around. I don't remember what the solution was. There was definitely more than one.
Yeah. Yeah, that was good. That was all good. And that was the one where at the very end we like found a person like trapped by a warding spell or something. And everyone's like, we should just leave them alone. And I'm like, no, we should break them out. Everyone's like, no.
They're
a demon. All right. Gotta stick with my oath of devotion. Gotta save them.
And I think they ended up being yokel.
They're always a yokel, dude.
It's always,
Perfect. Well, yeah, I mean, let us know, listener, what your thoughts are on traps, successes, failures, whatever you've put together, memorable traps. And let us know if you have anything.
Yeah. And with that, thanks for listening.
Next time on Monsters and Multiclass.
And join us next time as we discuss the Sorcerer class with Lex Olden, or Call Me Thay, one of the friends of the show. Perfect. Good as any of our other outros.